Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, continuing our conversations about the cultures of consciousness. One of my hobbies of late is collecting New Age music from the 1970s and 80s. It's already kind of a trend. I know I'm not super cutting edge on this one, but it's kind of fun. It's gotten me back into thrift store shopping, and on the West Coast, there's a lot of opportunities to buy LPs, but also cassettes, because if you're a bona fide New Age music collector, you got to get into the cassettes, because a lot of stuff came out on cassette and sounds pretty good on cassette. A few months ago, we spoke with the musician Laraji, and we talked about some of the roles that spirituality and expanded consciousness and electronics have to play in sort of creating the sort of foundation for New Age music, which can go by many names, as we'll be talking about this hour as well. But another long-standing resource for music, not just of that time, but of the whole genre extending into our contemporary moment, is, of course, Stephen Hill's long-running Hearts of Space radio program, which I listen to on KPFA, which I believe is the origin of Stephen's work back in the 70s. If you've had the pleasure of listening to the show, you know that it covers a wide range of experimental, electronic, cross-cultural, New Age, and what Stephen likes to call space music, which is probably the best overall term for this genre, which his show in some ways helped kind of clarify and define as a space not only of music production and music listening, but also a kind of state of mind. Hearts of Space itself indicating a sort of the possibility for music to open up spaces, not only a sense of an inner life, but cosmic dimensions, other dimensions, different zones of the natural world, of the seashore, of the forest, of the windy mountaintop, and then to sort of fill these spaces with emotion, with affect, with sort of peculiar atmospheres and wonderful openings. And so it's a very interesting place in music, because you have not only just the enjoyment and consumption of music that's made with modern instruments or ancient instruments, but also it veers into questions of consciousness, of expanded consciousness, of music as something that functions to heal and to open up psychological dimensions, spiritual dimensions that sort of go beyond the way that most people think about music, at least today. Though, of course, if you go back in time and you look at the way that music functioned in more traditional and archaic societies, of course, these spiritual and cosmic and altered states dimensions are really there pretty much probably at the origins of music making. So in some ways, contemporary spiritual music sort of comes around again and makes demands about what music can and should mean and activate in the self, but in today's terms. So I was very happy that Stephen agreed to come on to Expanding Mind and talk about Hearts of Space and space music and where stuff is going. I mean, he's a consummate radio professional on top of being a maestro of sort of overseeing these sort of multiplicitous genres of contemplative music. And his show, Hearts of Space, I think is the longest running, most popular, independently syndicated contemporary music show around. Which says a lot for a music that's kind of still marginalized by a lot of people, even sophisticated listeners, even if some of the shows they'll like, some of the bands they'll like, the whole idea of it is still, it's a niche, but it's a very powerful and deep one that strikes at the heart of a lot of issues in technology and consciousness, as well as music. Just to give you a little taste of the sort of topics of the show, Stephen always introduces the show with a little wrap, and you can kind of read descriptions of it on the Hearts of Space website as well, HOS.com. Recent shows have been Indotronica, arguably post-ambient, vernal transit, and expansion. And one of my favorite things about the show is Stephen's voice, which is calm and contemplative the way you would expect or want for a show that's based on space music, on sort of opening up these sort of drifting atmospheric kinds of environments. But there's a little bit of Rod Serling to it. I don't know whether it's because he's inviting us to another kind of twilight zone, but there's a little bit of a kind of invitation into an alternative world with a little more intensity than you might expect with a soft voiced person introducing contemplative music. So with that said, Stephen, thanks so much for joining us on Expanding Mind.
You're welcome, Eric. Thank you for inviting me. That was great. I think I should go home now. You've said it all.
I have to say, that's not the first time people say that when I do my intros. But really, I just really appreciate the show, and a lot of people do. There's I've been exploring the website, and you have a nice section where people send in their reviews, and it's such an interesting mix of people and perspectives on how the music functions in people's lives, and that's part of what makes me interested about, let's call it, new age music or space music in the contemporary world for over the last, 30, 40 years, is the idea that on top of enjoying music or having it support your cooking or your reading at home or, occupying you while you drive, that there are sort of other things that it can do for you. It can calm you. It can physically energize you. It can open up subtle dimensions. It can support meditation and these other kind of consciousness practices. So we really see like it kind of spreads and opens the meaning of music. And since you've been doing this for so long, and since I'm a history buff and particularly a 70s buff, I would love to have you kind of go back and really talk about, in your own radio show and the music you were listening to and the world you were living in the Bay Area in the 70s and 80s, just how these different elements came together, how music and technology and consciousness began to cohere into something that you could recognize as a genre or a set of genres that had a specific character that you helped define and transmit through your radio show.
Okay. Well, all that took a while. My story is I moved from the East Coast to San Francisco in 1970 and arrived in the city. It was not as expensive and not as crowded as it is today, but it was possible, to find cheap apartments and stuff. So it was a good move for me, and it was an environment in 1970 that was just absolutely full of creative ferment and a sense of possibility. So it was really up to you to respond to it in some way that made sense for you individually. I had been trained as an architect and went to an East Coast graduate program in architecture. And I thought, I'd move out here and I'd get a job and I would do architecture and that would be that. As it turned out, I couldn't get a job in architecture because all the jobs were being filled by people coming out of Berkeley, which had a very good architecture school. So I started volunteering what was then the very beginning of KQED radio, KQED FM. At the time, they were just getting started. Originally, when I went there, they were on the air 8 hours a day, and then during my time as a volunteer there, they decided they would be on the air 16 hours a day. So they needed to hire more people, and I was a volunteer, so they hired me. And, because of that, and the fact that radio had been my hobby as a kid, people today don't understand that radio used to be a really big deal in the culture. I mean, it was the only really convenient method of getting audio content. There were radios everywhere. There were radios in cars, you know, starting in probably the 40s, so, or even before. And so it was possible, you know, for people to discover music and news and information on the radio. And that period also coincided with the beginning of public radio as a discernible subcategory. Here in the United States, they got, you know, some money from the government, and they got frequencies at the left-hand end of the dial that were theirs, and they basically took some of the liberal idealism of the 60s and translated it into a broadcast format that was different from commercial radio, and that's where I found a home. You know, in the early days on KQED, they offered me time, and I said, "Well, what are you talking about?" And the manager said, "Well, you've got 3 hours on Saturday night. Just do what you want." So that was, you know, a tremendous opportunity. I brought in some friends to help fill some of that time and did some more talk-oriented programming. But late at night, I would just start to play music. And I have to stress, I'm not a trained musician. I did play acoustic guitar, classical guitar, for a couple of years when I was a teenager, but I wasn't very good at it, and so I, you know, didn't continue. But I was a good listener. I was a, you know, real solid music fan. And so I had been collecting music, and in those days, collecting music meant boxes full of LPs and stuff you had to lug around and shelves you had to set up in order to have the stuff be accessible. And so, you know, I had done that, and, you know, I had started to discover certain things that for some reason just appealed to me more than the general run of popular music. You know, I was a big fan of Terry Riley right from the first time I heard him. I was also very deeply into Bach and also certain forms of what we now call world music, like flamenco. And this was all strictly an intuitive thing for me. I just liked what I heard. And I really wasn't particularly aware of the dimensions you described so well in your introduction. But it fairly soon became clear that there were just different categories of musical experience. And for one reason or another, I gravitated, you know, it was still, popular music was still really burgeoning in the early 1970s. But at the same time, there was a technical revolution that essentially enabled what we now call user-generated content. At that time, if you wanted to release a record, you needed to, I mean, before 1970, when the first inexpensive four-track recorders and relatively inexpensive recording equipment started to be sold, if you wanted to make a record, you had to sign a contract with a label of some size. You had to get a budget and then go into a professional studio to record it. And it was very expensive, and there was a pretty stiff filter for people. No record company would finance something like that unless they had a reasonable expectation that you would be able to sell a reasonable number of records and they would recoup their investment. But at the same time, for a few thousand dollars, it became possible to create a, what's now called a home studio. And that liberated a huge amount of creativity that had been nascent.
Yeah, it seems like the home studio is really interesting, and you know, obviously people used it in lots of different ways. You know, if you just think of the 70s, and then it, you know, whatever into the early 80s, you can hear lots of kind of music that comes out of it. And you can also hear even in commercial forms how certain bands like Boston comes to mind, where you can tell that basically the guy's sitting in his bedroom making all of this music, and then it just makes it to that level of like pop expression. But there's a certain quality to the home studio, and particularly the solo home studio.
Yeah.
But it seems like one of the things that happened with that was that a lot of people started to make the kind of music that you started to really tune into. So what is that connection? What was it about the tools of the home studio, as well as just the environment? Like, I'm in my bedroom. No one's going to bother me. I can go wherever I want with this stuff. And it seemed to, you know, led to all sorts of music, but it did seem to feed into the growth and really even the emergence of space music and new age music in a lot of ways. What was that connection?
The real connection was practical electronic instruments. We had a history through the 50s and 60s of experimental electronic music coming out of academic environments, but the tools were very customized and had to be built, you know, by hand, and it was just very difficult to get into electronic music. And then around, became a period where guys like Bob Moog and Don Buchla here in Berkeley built synthesizers and sold them as kits or sold them as completed instruments at reasonable prices. And there's no way you can exaggerate the impact of that on experimental, popular, and personal music. It sparked a revolution in what's called tone color music, because with synthesizers, it's trivial to create continuous tones. Before that, you would have needed a very special instrument, like a pipe organ or something equivalent, that could make continuous sounds. And a lot of effort has been expended over the years on adapting acoustic instruments in certain ways to create continuous sounds. If you think about it, arpeggios, tremolo, things like that are techniques of using instruments that have acoustic properties and where the sound decays over time, and kind of fooling the ear into thinking they're creating a continuous sound. So those things arrived, the rise of cheap synthesizers. Laurie Spiegel, this composer in New York City, eventually said she considered the synthesizer to be a folk instrument, by which she meant it was cheap, anybody could play it, it was easy, and it fueled the growth of personal music. Now, the other part of your question is, what's the psychological landscape that allows or that encouraged people to create this kind of music that attacks the question of experience and consciousness directly? And that's a lot harder to answer that question. Anything I would say about it would be, you know, personal speculation. But I would say that at that point, the rise of media of all kinds and the proliferation of television, radio, print, and all kinds of, this is even, you know, pre-internet, of course, was starting to accelerate people's day-to-day experience. And so something that slowed down that sense of experience became somewhat more exotic and desirable. and people simply look for slow experiences. If you think about it, today we have slow food and various other essentially conservative movements that are arguing that people should slow down and get back to old values. And that same sort of thing happened intuitively and organically within music production. You had the tools, you had the time, and you had the desire to create something that didn't sound like everything else, and out it comes. At the same time, there was also the rise of the New Age movement, which, you know, is a kind of form of grassroots spirituality. It's really hard to get a grip on it because it's so diverse and so unfocused in a way. It's all kinds of research and embracing of non-physical realities, non-scientific realities. You know, who knows where all that comes from, but you know, it arrived as a discernible category in media. Self-help books, New Age books, started to become a big deal. New Age bookstores proliferated during the 70s, and by the 1980s, there were thousands of them, to the point where they started to get interested in music and created a whole parallel distribution system for music, which that in itself, I've never seen that get the credit it deserves.
Well, and that's related to the cassettes as well.
Yeah, well, it was all cassettes because making LPs was still pretty expensive, and it was much more complicated. It required, you know, expensive mastering, expensive production, and then you had to commit to orders of at least 500 records, and it just cost a lot of money. Cassettes were cheap and eventually became much cheaper. And like MP3, cassette was the first medium that represented a step backward in sound quality, but was embraced by users, you know, by average listeners as good enough. So, you know, the rise of the New Age bookstores and boutiques made it possible for artists, independent artists with home studios, to find an alternative path to the market. They could simply send a cassette to a New Age distributor and say, here's my product, you know, I'd like you to sell it. They'd send a dozen of them to the distributor, and the distributor would start sending them out to stores. And, you know, for a couple of years there, it was possible to actually make a living doing that if you had a successful album.
Yeah. Well, one of the questions I want to ask, you know, if we start talking about New Age music, then most music fans are like, oh, God, you know, it's the last thing I want to spend any time with. There's all of these associations with this kind of music, modern contemplative music, with sort of cheesiness or Muzak or like the kind of stuff they play when you get a massage and da 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 da. And there's an interesting point on your website where you really kind of make this distinction between a certain kind of easy sentimentality or a nostalgic kind of slow music that's used just to sort of calm, almost like an inoculation or a kind of, you know, like a sort of, you know, whatever, put you into a little bit of a hypnotic state or just to kind of calm you down, versus music that, while it's using, it's playing off some of those calming, contemplative elements, is also doing something really rich and interesting as music. And in a lot of ways, your whole kind of, your job has been to help filter that distinction, because of course there is a lot of drac and really sentimental kind of music, or music that's just functioning purely like Muzak as just kind of background, whatever, to support a vague atmosphere in some kind of environment like a massage studio or whatever. As you've been working with that, how do you find, like, what is it, what does music need to, like, make that deeper move, even while it's still using that language of space and contemplation and calm?
All right, well, that's the real question, because what happened with the rise of New Age music was a completely unfiltered bunch of material became accessible, and there was a marketplace for it. What it was lacking was any sense of what used to be what was called A&R, or Artist and Repertoire, which was a filtering function that record companies, professional music companies, subjected all their artists and all their records to on the way to the marketplace. Without A&R, you basically, it was, you know, wide open for anybody to create exactly the kind of music they wanted and to, you know, put it into the distribution system, and there it would be in a store, and you had no idea what the level of quality of that music was. The only thing you could judge by was the packaging. Some people were pretty good at producing decent-looking packages with trivial music. And so, very quickly, New Age acquired a reputation for becoming a dumping ground for a lot of mediocre music. And within a very few years, it essentially, you know, created this cliche that's been, the genre has been saddled with ever since. It was clear to me that, you know, you had to take it album by album and artist by artist, that the way I see it, this is a sensibility, you know, the sense of the taste for slow experience or ambient music or meditative experience or meditative sound is kind of an inborn thing. I wouldn't say it's that everybody has it. I'd say probably, you know, roughly 35% of people, if you play some of that kind of music for them, they'll immediately respond to it and like it. And for those people, that is the beginning of a viable relationship with that kind of experience. As for, on the musician side, it's just a fact of life that some musicians have a more profound way of expressing themselves and a more profound grasp of the dimensions of their art than others. And my job as a music producer is to, you know, find those guys and then find the best pieces within their repertoire and sometimes edit those pieces so that they're more concise and, you know, can find their way into a one-hour radio show, which is essentially a compilation of the work of a bunch of artists. And, you know, this is just a fact of life. There are just differences in quality that are out there. And, you know, as a listener, if you're critical about that kind of stuff, you're going to look for artists you can depend on. You're going to look for programmers whose taste resonates with yours, and that's given me something to do for the last 40 years.
Yeah, and you've also been able to take advantage of the sort of changes in distribution and all that. I mean, we could talk forever about how the internet has changed music and streaming, and you have a, you know, Hearts of Space is a subscriber streaming model, and I take it a great example of how, of the long tail of how a niche market in our contemporary environment, when it has enough presence, can really do well because there's so many people who are interested in it, scatter all over the world, and now there's this perfect, nearly frictionless distribution system. So it seems like you've hung in there for a long time, and technology's caught up with you.
This is really about survival. In other words, musicians have the same problem, and I, as a music producer or music programmer, I've had a succession of small businesses. When we were a local radio show on KPFA from 73 onward to 1995. We had a mail order business. People would, you know, we published a little mimeograph catalog, and people could order music from us, and we'd fulfill it. That wasn't a very good business, but it worked for a couple of years. And then, you know, by 1983, we thought, well, maybe this stuff will work nationally, so we were able to syndicate a one-hour version of our local program. And so I was in the radio syndication business. We were charging public radio stations a fee to carry our show. And for a couple of years, that was a nice little business, even though public radio is a terrible place to try and make a living. I would be the first to let you, you know, to support that point of view. And so very quickly, the year after we syndicated, we started a record label. And the record label, you know, was essentially because we knew about the genre, and we had a lot of contact, with artists. And I was in a good position to be essentially an A&R guy for New Age music. So we started a label called Hearts of Space Records. And that business lasted for 17 years until about 2001. At that point, it was not viable for us to run an independent label anymore. We had amassed a sizable catalog, but even so, the changes in the commercial record business, the New Age bookstores were still there, but you know they were shrinking in terms of the size of their marketplace. And we had also started to distribute to commercial record stores, and that is simply a minefield of financial risk and danger. And the way that that evolved, it was just impossible for a label our size to survive within that environment. So we sold that business, and at that point, we had to reinvent ourselves again. And I looked around and saw that I had literally, in a closet, I had 700 Hearts of Space programs. So, you know, and we were constantly getting requests from the audience for copies of old shows, which legally we could not make and sell. So we did the next best thing. I started, you know, I was here in San Francisco. Streaming audio was being invented here and popularized by Bay Area companies and also by Real Audio up in Seattle. And, you know, it became clear to me, because I'm a bit of a technology buff, that it would be possible to start a streaming business and to charge money for it, for, you know, to subscribers. Subscription businesses can be very good businesses. If you want to see a good example of that, just look at HBO. You know, it's a pure subscription business, but it gives them a kind of freedom to operate in terms of the material, and it also frees them from the one thing that most devalues the media consumption experience, which is commercials. And so, you know, we were able to we made the same calculation that even though charging money to access our content was going to doom us to being small, that it was better to be small and have control over the experience than it was to be big and have to incorporate advertising or deal with the compromises in terms of content that are enforced on you when you try and appeal to everybody. And, you know, I'm a big fan of niches. Niches are something which, you know, have always been around, but, you know, have had different prognosis depending on the era that you were in. You know, if there was a good way to disseminate your information and something that would, you know, like small publishers, for example. You could have a series of books. I guess the best example I ever had about it was polka. There's a guy in Minneapolis who's the king of polka. Every book about polka, every record about polka, it comes from him. He is, you know, the master of polka. He owns that niche. And people that are into polka, they just, you know, that's who they do business with, and they're total, everybody's happy. So, you know, we decided to make a niche out of what I came to describe as contemplative music and sound experience broadly defined, meaning we didn't stick to just electronic music or to new age music or to meditative music or world music. We looked for that sensibility wherever we would find it.
Yeah, and that I'd love to ask a little bit about that, because one of the things that really interests me is how music can function, and especially the kind of stuff we're talking about, can function as part of a design space where you're kind of designing, and you being both the listener who's choosing, or the producer who's choosing and filtering, and also the musician. But there's kind of a design for a space or an environment within which experience happens. You know, if you take that broadly, you can say, yeah, all music does that. But there's something specific about this relationship of experience. It's like, here's some music that gives you it gives you some stuff, but you also kind of have to fill it in or explore it or make it come alive, partly with your own response, your own heart, your own focus, your own attention. So it becomes a kind of medium of experience in a very particular way. So I'd love to just kind of push you a little bit more on, since it's not about a particular genre, electronic, you know, Gregorian chant, tambura, you know, psychedelic space music, whatever. It's really about a kind of sensibility that involves the listener's own experience in a very particular way. So I'd love to hear you, I don't know, suss that out a little bit more.
Sure. Well, that's the one topic I can claim to have some sense of knowing what I'm talking about. Not on a scientific basis. Let's go back to the beginning of ambient music as a category, which would have been when Brian Eno defined that genre in the 1970s. And what he said is, people are using music as a form of landscape. They're playing it at low levels all the time in their environment and using it as a way of, I think he used the verb tint. They're tinting that environment. They're giving the environment, which is, you know, arguably neutral or something they take for granted, and they're giving it a character by playing a certain kind of music. So what is it about the kind of music they're choosing? Well, largely it was instrumental, and very often it was something that created what Eno called calm and a space to think. So let's unpack that. If you look around at the history of music, there was always a kind of music that was designed to create popular communication. It had lyrics. It had forms like songs, which were predictable and widely understood. And then there was music that told stories using those methods, what sometimes called mythical music. And there was also music that was designed for ceremony and to affect consciousness. And all these things were part of musical history. In addition, you know, in the history of European music from, the Middle Ages until now, there was a tradition of artistically mediated music where people were creating music purely as an art form and applying various methods and techniques to composing and creating that music. And everything that was involved with it. The tradition of using music as a background was not particularly widespread until we had recordings, because that was what made it possible to do that. But early records, like go back to the 78, where a record lasts for 3.5 minutes, and you needed a big machine, and you had to load it up in order to have, you know, to play an album, was a project. Slowly, we came to have the ability to play music continuously with less and less effort. So naturally, people started to take advantage of that. Radio, music radio programming is an example, music format. So if you have a top 40 radio station, that's creating a flow of songs, of popular songs, you know, based on programming decisions made by professional music programmers that are designed to create an audience. So people got used to using music this way, just due to, you know, technical and cultural options that became available to them. By around the 1970s, we also had drugs hitting the culture, especially marijuana, which, whatever else you want to say about it, it changed the way people heard music. And that was another element which contributed to the sensibility for ambient and contemplative sound experience. And then you had the rise of, you know, artists who wanted to cater to that marketplace and that taste and that sensibility, and, you know, the stuff we've already talked about. The New Age system evolved outside of the traditional record industry, but by the mid-1980s, the commercial record industry, you know, wanted a piece of it, so they named the genre New Age, which I always thought was a horrible mistake. It, you know, it was understandable from their point of view. The term already had marketing value, and so they wanted to extend that marketing value to music. But it meant that the quality of that music, you know, was increasingly unpredictable, and that's what, you know, given the opportunity for some artists to emerge, and composers like Brian Eno, you know, to essentially put their mark on that genre and create some kind of a standard. You know, at this point, it's really up to the individual listener to decide what's going to satisfy their needs and how discriminating and critical they want to be about the quality of the contemplative experiences they have. But psychologically, the way it works is we have these three-dimensional hearing systems that we all have. Every mammal hears in 3D. Even birds and insects have essentially localization of sounds, and the reason is the same in all cases. It has survival value. You have to be able to hear something coming at you that might be dangerous, and you have to be able to escape or you're out of the gene pool. So we have these 3D hearing systems, and music was, of course, I mean, reproduced music was always mono until sometime in the 50s when stereo was invented. Actually, stereo was invented earlier, but it didn't practically make it into the marketplace until the rise of the LP. And stereo creates an image of space, of a virtual environment between the two speakers. Actually, the original stereo system was three speakers with a center speaker, because the center channel, the virtual center channel in stereo is not really very good. So for even today in film, we have a surround system that uses left, center, and right in front, and side and rear stereo systems in the back, in order to create a fully three-dimensional reproduction system. But we also had, with the Walkman, in came people listening to music on headphones, which before that were strictly a professional tool. You know, it was just used by radio people and musicians when they were working. But once you had the Walkman, you had millions of people listening on here on headphones, which created a more immersive reproduction system, and even the ability to fool the brain with formats like binaural audio, which are not quite the same as stereo. It's a form of stereo, but it's one that reproduces the natural cues that your ears are decoding. Your spatial localization system is decoding to give you a sense of where you are in space. And it wasn't a big step from there to creating a form of music that uses those spatial cues and information as part of its artistic signature. And that's basically where we are today. We're slowly moving toward virtual reality reproduction systems, which will integrate surround formats for music with visuals, and give us a sense and fool our perceptual systems into thinking we're in that space. But, you know, this is all part of a very long evolution, not only in media, but in our psychology. So that's the sort of basic setup.
Well, let's talk about, we have about 10 minutes left, about the psychology a little bit more, in the sense of, since you've been working with this music for so long, and and being tuned into audience desires and audience uses for so long, and how that's changed and shifted, and there's new names and new, you know, all the whole epic of it. How is it changing psychologically? Like, even if we compare today to the 70s or 80s, in terms of people, why are people drawn to this music? How are they listening to it? What do they expect out of it? How does the technology start to change the experience? What do you, you know, how has it evolved, really? Not so much in terms of the particular ways that people are making music, but how it's serving people, how people interpret it or weave it into their own minds.
Okay, well, if I say I'm an electronic music programmer to somebody in their 20s or early 30s, they're going to think about electronic dance music. And that is, you know, a big popular part of electronic music today. But obviously that music has a very different function. The interesting thing is that in clubs, with the rise of house music and disco and techno formats, there was also a simultaneous development of a quieter, more ambient kind of music that was eventually called chill. And chill rooms, you know, are still an aspect of clubs and gatherings and festivals, where they'll have multiple stages, and they'll attempt to program at least one of those rooms or stages with a quieter, more, let's say, arguably consciousness enhancing kind of material, for the very least, so that you can just, you know, get a little rest instead of being, you know, completely attacked by loud, propulsive rhythmic music 24/7. That's the biggest area in which things have changed. At the same time, because of the fact that, you know, we've now had, like, since the 70s, this era of self-publication, the total amount of ambient space and contemplative music that's accessible to an interested listener is now nearly infinite. I mean, it's huge. I'm on, you know, I have a Spotify subscription, so I get a Spotify playlist every Monday, and it'll have between 2.5 and 3 hours of music that they think somebody with my taste would be interested in. And I would say 90% of those artists I've never heard of, and I'm supposed to know about this stuff.
That's amazing, man.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's a just a, we're in this period that technology has all of a sudden flipped the equation. We went from relative scarcity. Scarcity was the business model of music companies. Radio was based on scarcity. There were only so many frequencies. It used to be that in the 70s, there were about 3,000 active artists on all the major labels and all the indie labels. That was it, 3,000 artists. Whereas, you know, just as a data point, when MP3.com opened their system up in the 90s to independent artists to upload music in relatively no time at all, like a year, they had 500,000 artists. So quite obviously there was a huge unfulfilled creative potential in personal music once distribution was out of the way as a gating factor. And that's where we're at now. We've got this infinite amount of material that's accessible. I mean, when you go to Spotify or Apple Music and you're looking down the front end of a database with over 30 million items in it, it's, you know, it's overwhelming. And obviously things, this is where programmers come back into the equation. Whether it's a guy writing an algorithm that's going to go through that 30 million database and try and make some sense out of it and put a name on it that will, you know, communicate with users, like greatest Saturday morning ever or something like that, whatever they call it. I mean, they have these completely weird names for the things they're doing. But nevertheless, this whole idea of music personalization and trying to give the user a little bit more of a useful filtering system, whether it's done mechanically or done by individuals, it doesn't really matter. The point is it's trying to provide a service of dealing with this kind of super abundant environment that we're in.
I know it's so stressful. I'm gonna need to listen to some space music to calm down.
That's right. Well, you know, I do. There's something to that. I mean, you know, I think it's simply, I alluded to that earlier, as the speed of life increased, people needed to be a little more strategic or tactical, at least, about how they calm themselves down. It's like we've got an infinite variety of stimulants. We need a reasonable corresponding variety of things to slow us down and calm us down. But I have to stress that when it comes to music, relaxation is just the precondition for getting into a space where you can actually hear deeper, what are called, you know, deep listening forms of music. And, you know, I'm not going to put a value on that. You either gravitate toward that kind of value or you don't. You may not even know it's possible, and that's fine. But for people who do know, you know, they've had deeper experiences in listening, and they crave them, and they want to go back. They want to be able to reproduce that level of profundity in their sound experience again. They're going to be more attuned to tools and people that allow them to find that.
Yeah, and it's funny. I think that stuff is still, in a weird way, kind of an open secret. Like, it's there. It's in the music zone. It's the records are in the record store and the iTunes or wherever. There's books out there. There's information. But just given how much attention and space pop music takes, it's in some ways a very beautiful place where there is this open secret. There really is a world of very profound listening. You might like some tracks more than others, but yeah, there's a way of listening beneath even taste that is available and open to us that is really quite extraordinary in a meditative, consciousness hacking kind of sense. Your show has been a great place to open up that and to keep that open secret open.
Open Secret is the name of a New Age bookstore here in San Rafael where I live.
Synchronicities, man.
Yes,
well, we got to wrap it up here. So, Stephen, I just wanted to thank you so much for joining us on Expanding Mind.
It was my pleasure, Eric, anytime.
Great, great. And again, folks, want to check out Hearts of Space, HOS.com, and there's samples there, and definitely check it out. It's really a worthwhile place in the dimension of one's listening. So from each of all you out there,